Hello, my name is Denise Lee Yan. I'm the director of the Faith and Work Journey, and you're in for a real treat. Here's an interview with author, speaker, and praxis partner Andy Crouch about his perspectives on the unprecedented isolation, anxiety, and depersonalization that characterizes most of our current cultural context, and how we as Christians should navigate the current challenges of technological change, disruptive relationships, and broken communities. The interview took place on March 31st, 2022 in the San Francisco Bay Area and was sponsored by the Dupree Center, Faith and Work Journey, Faith and Work Movement, GFM InterVarsity, and New College Berkeley. In our conversation, Andy and I touch on how to design and use technology as instruments that extend human skill through heart, soul, mind, and strength, instead of as devices that tend to exert mastery over us. We also talk about why and how we need to dethrone the power of mammon over our lives and reject the destructive notion of abundance without dependence upon each other. And Andy speaks about how people who are regarded as, quote, unuseful, those who seem to have nothing to offer to mammon, must be moved toward the center of attention and agency. Take a listen.
Who is Andy Crouch? Well, a few things about him. Okay, he is partner for theology and culture at Praxis, which is an organization that works as a creative engine for redemptive entrepreneurship. And I'm sure he would love to tell you more about that. So if you have questions about that, feel free to ask him. He's also a popular speaker and author so far of four books, with a fifth one coming out. One of the books, Culture Making, came out how long ago, Andy? Probably, yeah, quite a while ago, Culture Making, but it made a profound impact on me in the way that I think about my work and the way that I interact with the culture around here. And so it's just a real personal privilege to have you here. But I just wanted to mention that there are four books that he's written so far, and then a fifth one that we'll talk about tonight. Also, Andy is the former editor of Christianity Today and a governing board member of Fuller Theological Seminary and InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. He's also a musician, an avid cyclist, and all sorts of other interesting things about him that I could say. But without further ado, please welcome Andy Crouch. All right. Well, Andy, thank you again for being here. We really appreciate you being here. And where did you fly in from? Where is home for you?
Home is Philadelphia, just outside of Philadelphia, so all the way across the country.
Wow. But
well, okay. Worth the trip.
Yes, I'm sure. I'm sure. Well, I want to dig right into the topic of tonight, and
thank
it's
you.
Your upcoming book, The Life We're Looking For, Reclaiming Relationship in a Technological World.
Yes.
And so first, just let's start off with, why did you write this book?
I always write to figure out what I think. Writing is thinking, and until you write, you really don't know what you think, as you find out when you try to write and realize you don't know what you think. So this was a project that emerged from a couple of years of already thinking, writing about technology. I wrote this book called The TechWise Family that was very much for parents and kids thinking about how we can put technology in its proper place in the home. And as I worked on that, I realized there was more to say about it that wasn't just within the frame of family. There's bigger things going on in our world that didn't fit into that book, which was kind of designed to be a very practical book and very specific. And I really did want to figure out, what do I believe is actually at the heart of the amazing power that we have and the amazing loneliness that we experience? So we are the most powerful people in history by most possible measures of that phrase, and the most lonely, anxious, and depressed in at least certain respects, people in history at the same time. This is not how it's supposed to be, you know? And so why? What went wrong? And I also was starting to feel like it was very easy to critique, and, you know, we can talk about the critiques, but I actually felt like I was starting to glimpse some ways that we could actually redesign. So the book is very much not just about what's gone wrong, but how can we redesign? So that's sort of what I set off to do. And then writing is an adventure. You get to the end and you didn't do exactly the thing you imagined. And there's lots in this book that I couldn't have envisioned ahead of time. And that's been fun. And it's very exciting that in 2 weeks it'll be out in the world. And it's sad that it's not here tonight. But it's sort of like, I don't know, talking about a baby that's about to arrive. So,
right,
you know, it's
right.
kind of fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you for giving me a preview of the book.
Yeah, you got to
read
it.
I had a chance to read it. I'm like, if I'm going to interview you, I better know what I'm talking about. So thank you for the opportunity to do that. And I can't wait for everyone else to get exposed to it. But in reading it, there were two topics that really stood out to me. I think because we are here in the Bay Area, and I think that these two topics are particularly important and particularly relevant to us. One of them is money and finance, and the other is technology. And so I want to dig into both of those. So let's
right.
first dig into money, okay? And you kind of already talked about how, you know, we are a powerful people, but at the same time, it seems like we give money maybe power over us, or perhaps, our relationship with money tends to be the struggle of power. So I wanted you to kind of talk a little bit about what that power that money has over us and how we can guard our hearts against have too much power over us.
I suppose money, like a lot of things, is a great servant, terrible master, and something that starts out as a servant but sometimes ends up as a master. And I actually think part of what's going on is that, in fact, though we benefit tremendously from the market economy that we participate in, and the to the extent that money circulates around us, it's not always a bad thing. But I do think that I see our technological world is built on three revolutions, and the first one is the financial revolution. So date it back to the 14th century when the Medicis invent double entry accounting. And we start to have this way for the emerging merchant class of Europe at that time to account for and build wealth in ways that are liberated from real things. It becomes a ledger. And the turning of money from the turning of wealth from land, which was inherently productive, to gold, which you still had to cart around and is less productive, to ledger, and ultimately just to imagination, because the truth is now money is entirely imagined. And we've managed to imagine $2 trillion more dollars in the past few years than we imagined before. Like,
you saying that if I just imagined that I had a lot of money, that I would
just dream it?
Right.
Well, it doesn't work at the individual level. So that's called fraud. But it does work at the level of fiat currency. And this revolution, in which money gets liberated from its rootedness in place and in human relationship, is a tremendous engine of growth. And I certainly don't think it's wrong, in one sense. I do think that anything that gets liberated from place and personal relationship kind of flies off from the created world and becomes potentially part of what Paul calls the principalities of the powers of the air being this kind of atmosphere that you can't grasp, that acts back on us even though we try to access it and use it for our purposes. And it does feel like when we have money, we have power, and yet to enter in the system of acquiring and using money is also to become kind of a subject of money. And this is maybe gets to this idea in the book that what is technology really serving? There's a very interesting book by Craig Gay, who's teaches at Regent College. He's a Christian theologian. A really good book called Modern Technology and the Human Future. And he makes this really interesting observation. He says, a lot of technology doesn't actually seem to serve ordinary embodied human existence. That doesn't seem to be why a lot of things are developed, to actually just help us to be ordinary embodied human people. Some of it does, but some of it doesn't. And his argument is actually what technology is actually serving is what he calls profit. The generation of profit is the logic that drives technological development. But in the book, what I call it is mammon, which is Jesus' word, for money that has become a power of the air and that no longer just serves human beings as a unit of exchange and, you know, or unit of account, store of value, those three things that you learned in econ, but plays this strangely powerful role in our world that feels like a will of its own. And I think that's best called mammon.
Mm-hmm. So maybe could you piece that apart for us a little bit more? I actually heard you give a talk where you were contrasting kind of money and mammon. Maybe for those of us who aren't as familiar with this concept of mammon, can you explain that a little bit more?
Right. So this is the interesting thing. So Jesus says you cannot serve. It's one of Jesus' most famous things he said. You cannot serve God. And then the question is, what does he say? So he was speaking Aramaic, presumably. Jesus probably spoke Aramaic his whole life. His Greek biographers, when they tell the story of his life in what we call the Gospels, they normally translate it into Greek. But every once in a while, they leave a word untranslated. And in this case, they leave it untranslated, this Aramaic word, mammon, whatever. And they just put it into Greek letters, but they don't turn it into the Greek word for money. Now, what kinds of words do you leave untranslated? I suppose you leave notably powerful utterances like talitha cum is another thing that they leave in the Greek. It's this moment when Jesus raises a girl from the dead. And somehow Mark, as he tells the story, is like, I think I want to tell you what he actually said. I'm not just going to put it in Greek. Well, the other thing you leave untranslated is names, right? So names, just because Peter is called Peter, we don't call him Rocky, even though that's kind of would be the translation, right? That's his name, Rocky. We leave it basically the way it was. And Mark, in his gospel, leaves it mammon, which implies that Mark thinks Jesus is talking not just about a substance or an idea, but something with a quasi-personal quality. So I take mammon to be the name of a demon, the name of a power that has set itself against God, that wills things that are not for human flourishing and not for God's intention, but are actually anti-human and anti-God, indeed anti-Christ. And I suppose there are many demons that in various ways hijack aspects of human experience, but this is the one that hijacks the use of money. So this is the will in the world that operates like the power of the air, whatever that exactly means, that attaches itself to our experience of money. And I often think it's helpful to think of the demonic as whispering, whispers to us. If you orient your life around this, you will have, and then what does it promise? And I got this phrase from a friend of mine named John Tyson, and he said, mammon promises abundance without dependence. Abundance without dependence. You will have just a profusion of the things you want in the world, the good things that you were made to want, even by God, but without dependence. Because when I have money, I don't need relationship. I walk into any store, and if I have that little piece of imagination called a credit card, in which I don't even need money, I just need faith, which is what credit is. Credit means faith, right? Only believe. So it is like what you said. Actually, come to think of it, I can't imagine. I mean, and they tell me I have spending power.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, I have a lot of spending power.
$25,000 worth of
it. Exactly. I would be in big trouble if I used all that spending power. But so I've got my imagination card in my pocket. I pull it out, and that cashier is telling me whatsoever I may desire from that store knows nothing about me, does not know my parents, doesn't know where I live, may not really register my name, and I still get what I want. So I have magically moved through the world without a bit of relationship with my fellow human beings, and I still have what I want. Well, that's awesome. And maybe a little unsettling, because now I move through a world that never recognizes me, that where I can float free of all connection. And this starts to get to why I think in the world that Mammon has made, we have much of the power we imagined. But what Mammon didn't really explain is that when you live without dependence, you live without love. When you live without love, it's a lonely life. When you live a lonely life, you are almost certainly going to be anxious and depressed, and there will be no one there. You're no longer in a relational matrix that holds you in the vulnerabilities of life. And now you are dependent on getting more of this imaginary thing to secure yourself. That's all. Other than that, everything's great.
Okay, well, I definitely want to talk about the impact on relationships. But before I go there, I do want to ask you just about money and finance in general, because I think a lot of us here in the Bay Area either work in finance in the VC world, or we rely on VCs and investors for the livelihood of our companies and therefore our jobs. And in the book, you write this phrase or the sentence, the more time we spend in the world that money makes, the more we become conformed to its image. Does that mean that those of us who work in finance shouldn't be, or somehow we need to be separating ourselves from that world?
Well, separating ourselves from the dream, yes. The dream of abundance without dependence, I think, is a disastrous dream for anyone who indulges in it. But I actually think, to the extent that money simply names and recognizes value, the creation of value, which human beings are gifted to do by virtue of being image bearers of God, that is, we are able to take one set of conditions, and through the application of ingenuity and attention and skill and a kind of patience with the world, we can make new things that that expand the amount of value in the world. And if money is a unit of account, that is, it's how we count value, then the money supply actually should expand as human making expands the very goodness of the world. So somebody needs to steward that. Somebody needs to handle the allocation of value, help assign value, help register value, and also help to kind of underwrite new ventures, let's say. So I do not want, in fact, people to leave their jobs, but I do think there's two things Mammon does not care about that if you're a Christian in these fields, you've got to like discipline your life to care about. And one is simply people. Because the whole principle of Mammon is it would be much better if we could get things done without people. The other thing Mammon really thinks is it would actually be better if we could get things done without the created world. So I think the demonic wills a world without persons and a world without matter. It's anti-material. The demonology, the sort of history of Christian reflection on who are these forces that disobey God, that resist God, appear in only fragmentary ways in the Bible itself. One sort of consensus has been they were very angry when God made a material world because they are spirits. And the angels, some of this is speculative, you know, we only get little hints of it. But it's suggested that the angels worshiped God because of this beautiful outpouring of love and creation. But the demonic, like, separated from God because you've taken away the power of the air. And now we've got chairs and bodies and, you know, messy actual engagement in an actual creation. So Mammon hates those things. So I suppose, actually, if you're in finance, you need to, like, discipline yourself to love the real. You are spending all your days in a world of imagination, even a fruitful world of imagination. But, like, love the plant, you know? Oh, it's plastic, sorry. I was hoping it might be, like, a real plant, but find a real plant to love. But much more importantly, love the person.
Yeah.
Who you so easily can treat as the subject of a transaction. yeah. in which you're trying to extract abundance from their creativity. The other thing I think you have to learn to love is the other thing Mammon really doesn't like, which is patience. So Mammon is in a hurry, or at least Mammon wants you to be in a hurry. And this is why IRR is internal rate of return, which is money as a function of time. Return on money is a function of time. It is a necessary tool for comparing certain value propositions, but it is a very dangerous spiritual practice. Because God, it is very hard to argue that God is in the IRR business, which is basically shrinking the amount of time within which you get a certain amount of return. We live in a universe that's 13 point something billion years old, which extremely patiently coalesced out of what seems to have been a big bang of creation into first extremely elemental things. And then there was all this long, long history of just the formation of the elements that eventually give us a plastic plant in the heart of the fusion furnaces we call stars. And God, and I think this is very congruent with the biblical account, even though the biblical account knows nothing of modern cosmology. There's this unhurriedness, even of the Genesis 1 account, where God makes, he speaks, it's so, it's good, and then he rests. He's not like, come on, we got to get some return here, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think patience and people, I like to say persons, because people is kind of a clumps people together, whereas persons calls your attention to every person you encounter. And Mammon does not want you to pay attention to those things. So the radical countercultural thing to do when you work in finance is like swim against the stream of IRR, not that you don't employ it at some level in your analysis, it's a tool. Swim against the stream of transaction in terms of how you treat other people and just relentlessly pay attention. There is a person before me. It's going to take time to know them. It's going to take time for any good they bring into the world to reach its full multiples. So we talk at Praxis about thinking much more about multiples on investment, MOI, rather than IRR. God has put us in the world for unbelievable dimensions of flourishing, but with no hurry. And so we should align as much as we can our finances with MOI rather than IRR.
Love that. And I promise I want to get to the relationship thing, but I want to make sure that I cover off on technology, because I think that that was the other thing that I was very challenged by when I read your book, in the sense that you talked about advanced technology. So first, I want you to kind of describe what you mean by advanced technology.
Right.
And then, you know, I guess I have a bias that I think that like advanced technology has contributed so much good in this world. It's how we've progressed. There's so much development. There's so much capability. But obviously, it also has caused a lot of problems. And I think that your book really talks about a lot of the problems that tech has, advanced technology has created. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Right. So maybe I'll do it in two steps. So the first is to say a common thing that people think and say is that, well, we have technology today, but human beings have always had technology. So, you know, the plow is a technology, hammer is a technology. So we just have more sophisticated things. And of course, there's some truth to that. There's a kind of continuity of human beings trying to extend themselves in the world, bring new things into the world beyond what we can do just with our own heart, soul, mind, strength, constitution. I do think we started using the word technology because something had changed. If something hadn't changed, we'd just talk about tools, better tools. And in fact, we picked up this word that initially meant a kind of a different thing in the 19th century. And we're like, oh, let's start calling this new thing technology, because it is different. And the way it's different is, and I'm very influenced by a philosopher named Albert Borgman, who talks about devices in a particular way. Devices have a new quality in the history of human making and human tools, which is they operate on their own. So a hammer does not self-hammer, right? But a nail gun gets closer. And who does not want to own a nail gun? I mean, it's like the coolest thing, right? A hammer requires a great deal of skill, more than you would ever imagine if you have not picked up a hammer and tried to hammer something. But the first few times you try to hammer something, you're like, hey, wait, this is so hard, right? A nail gun does not require as much skill, though in the hands of a really skilled carpenter, it can do things that I couldn't do with it, right? So the transition from tool to device is a transition to things that begin to operate either semi or entirely autonomously with their own cybernetic feedback loops that help them maintain control in a chaotic world and with their own sources of power, and also that require less and less human engagement and skill. And that transition from tools, which got more and more, in one sense, complex, but always required a human being to like lean into it and use it, to things that you just plug it in and it goes, that's a big transition. So, and that transition feels is very significant to human beings. We're like, oh my goodness. And Aristotle dreamed of it way back. He was like, if you could have a harp that plucked itself, that would be really something. Well, now we have Spotify, which I think counts as a harp that plucks itself, and every other instrument, right? And we always dreamed of it, and when we dreamed of it, we thought, that would be magic. That would be magic. So this gets to your question about sufficiently advanced technology. I'm riffing here on Arthur C. Clarke, who very famously said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Magic is this ancient human dream that we could have instant, effortless power. That without exerting ourselves, without becoming something or someone different, right? So for me to really wield a hammer, I have to learn the hammer. I have to change. That I could just will nailing. Like, just nail. Let there be nailing, you know?
Let my car drive.
Yes, how about that, right? So instead of having to ride on a horse, which takes a lot of strength, takes a lot of attention, or even drive a car, the dream is always in this direction of, I'm now disengaged, I just wish to go, and I go. That's magic. And Arthur C. Clarke says, that's sufficiently advanced technology. As a Christian, I think he's almost exactly wrong. Any sufficiently advanced technology should be very readily distinguishable from magic, because the truth about magic is, it doesn't have a great track record. So magic doesn't actually work. And magic is a long failed story of human beings believing there's some trick that if we could turn the corner and find that trick, our condition would be altered. We would live lives of incredible power and leisure. We would live lives of incredible independence. And the world would just operate on our behalf. And this has turned out over and over in human history to be a very, very bad idea. At a spiritual level, it invites in forces that I think we have to reckon with as demonic. But at a practical level, what happens when you discover the magic isn't working is you go to find someone to do the job that the magic will not do. So there's this famous kind of story, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, that is best known because Mickey Mouse did a version of it. And Mickey dreams of magical brooms, right, that will carry the water for him up the stairs. And the problem is his magic doesn't really work because the broom gets its own ideas and starts carrying way too much water, and then he can't stop it. And I think this is a parable of what happens when we try to do magic. It goes beyond it turns out the power doesn't stay with us. And it turns out that as we watch the magic happen, we're actually becoming subject to it. And then someone said something really interesting to me just the other night when I was sharing this idea. He said, it kind of feels in our modern technological world like we thought that it would do all the broom thing for us. But when you work in the modern technological world, you kind of feel like one of the brooms. Like we feel like one of these, we feel pressed into service by our own devices.
Yes.
And that's actually what magic has always done. It flips the tables on the magician, and the magician ends up alienated, lonely, compelled, compulsive, and not actually free to just enjoy the world. So a sufficiently advanced technology would not disengage us, but would deeply engage us. Would not say, you don't have to become anything different to get things done. No, actually, to get something of real value done in the world requires growth, requires change. And yet, it would extend us in new ways that would indeed be delightful and worthwhile, but not disengage us. But honestly, what many, many people feel about technology, even the parts of technology that they freely adopted on their own, like the glowing rectangles we all carry in our pockets, like this thing that was supposed to serve us has a mind of its own and turns us into brooms rather than being the broom.
Yeah.
And I think that's the history of magic. And so I would say we've got to create actually sufficiently advanced technology that stays entirely rooted in the created world, stays rooted in the conditions of being a human person, and that always invites us to engage rather than inviting us to sit back and watch it do its thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Yes. It's challenging to think about that's what technology has become for us. Like, we kind of think, well, of course it's our phone or it's our car, we're still in control. But when you talk about it the way it's like, oh, yes.
We don't feel so in control.
No.
And that's because...
And not just because Alexa's going off in the kitchen when you're, like, talking to this.
Exactly. Don't say her name. Don't say her name. Definitely don't say the S-I-R-I word. Like, 15 S-I-R-Is will speak up. Did you want something? I didn't quite get that.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so let's go to this, you set the stage, we're in this culture, in this context where money and technology are so pervasive. How are we, to use your words, to reclaim relationship given this context?
So I think I have two thoughts. One is, simply, like, we have to renovate our dreams. We have to reimagine what the good life would be. And the good life is not a life in which I have either kind of incredible ease or kind of the other side of it is this idea of superpowers. Like, I just sort of... You know, it's interesting. Superpowers are strangely inert in that the original superhero, Superman, he just seems to decide to fly. Like, he doesn't even have to flap or anything, you know? And he's just like, oh, just will it. And then, woo, it's happening. And that's a very powerful dream for human beings. And I think it's a very dangerous dream. So we've got to reimagine. Actually, I am a heart, soul, mind, strength complex designed for love. That's my definition of a person. A heart, soul, mind, strength complex designed for love. And my dream for my life is the full development of all four of those dimensions of being human and the direction, the redirecting my life in the direction of love. That's the only worthwhile goal of my life. And when I start thinking that way, superpowers are of very little use to that because superpowers don't develop my heart. Don't develop my strength. Quite the opposite, right? If I let the nail gun do it, I will never develop the neuromuscular coordination to wield a hammer. I will atrophy. I think it's significant that the defining, with a 2-year exception that we've all just lived through, there was a defining public health challenge that is still really bigger, far bigger than any pandemic ever was or will be. And it's metabolic syndrome, which is, you know, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, overweight, high blood sugar. And this complex of its own, of pathologies, we've never before had our number one public health problem be non-infectious. But this is the biggest danger to human flourishing and the biggest cost driver in our medical system. And it comes entirely from the fact that we now have superpowers. Namely, we are inactive. Our bodies are not asked to do something. When we thought about what technology would do, we were like, well, first, let's stop having to move. Like, gosh, if I could just sit all day, that would be good, right? This turns out to be horrible for human beings. And so we need to change the dream to, no, I am not willing to put up with technology that makes me sit still. I mean, this is a very radical idea. Like, what if we decided, no, if I'm going to do thinking, I'm going to do it the way Socrates did it. I'm going to do it the way Jesus did it. I'm going to walk. And tech, you got to come along and help me walk rather than make me stare at a screen in a way that's very actually closes down imagination, closes down the body. The body ends up, you know, kind of turned in on itself. No, I need to be out in the world, moving through the world. So that's, I guess I'm actually getting to the second thing. So reimagining what the good life is. and then redesigning the technology. So this is why this is a big part of why I'm here, like literally here in Silicon Valley, and I'm here for 9 days because there's not many places I would go for 9 days to be with people and really talk through these things. But you all are so proximate to the decisions we make about what we're trying to design. And if we started to design, instead of devices, design what I might call instruments. So if you think about medical instruments, musical instruments, surgical instruments, instruments is a word we use often for things that are quite complex. Like that grand piano over there is a super complicated, mostly industrial. It's not high tech, but there are high tech versions. But it never plays itself. It waits for a human being to develop deep skill, not just of hands and coordination, fine motor skills, but emotion, the ability to communicate emotion through music, mind, the ability to hold in one's mind complex expressions of music. What's all I miss? Oh, soul. Well, I don't know. I hope there's soul in this church. I had to go to the black church to learn soul, so I apprenticed at St. James's. Amen. I apprenticed at St. James's AME Zion Church as a pianist and trained in the Western classical tradition, and I discovered that I was missing something. And what I was missing was depth of self, like the ability to bring depth of self, including depth of pain, to the expression even of joy in the form of music, right? So an instrument requires a person to bring all that. And this is same thing with my wife's a scientist, so she uses scientific instruments. And she doesn't go in and be like, I have physics superpowers. Like I just make, I mean, if you've met any physicists, there are no physics superpowers. Most days, the stuff doesn't even work. And you're pushing yourself, because the difference between science and technology is technology, as applied science, is designed to feel easy. But science, which is done with super high tech, but done with instruments, is actually as hard as anything human beings do, and yet yields these amazing, beautiful, elegant, and also useful results through the use of instruments. So I think we need to like go back to basics and essentially with every single thing that right now is a device, say, how could this be more of an instrument that fully engages a person, heart, soul, mind, and strength?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious, everything you said really resonates with me on multiple levels. I want you to talk about how it could or should resonate with me, given that I'm a Christ follower. Like, how does this call to reimagine dreams and redesign technology, how is that different from that, given that we are Christians here?
Wow.
Or is it? Maybe it's not.
I will say, I mostly feel like this is a human predicament that we need to solve alongside all of our fellow humans, whatever their beliefs may be at this point in their lives about ultimate reality. I think probably the biggest difference in being Christian is a much higher capacity to see suffering as redemptive. So I think that the natural human belief is, gosh, if I didn't have to feel pain, that would just be better in every way. And of course, I certainly would never hope to inflict pain on any person. But pain is part of the human story. And our Savior embraced it for a purpose. Not in an absurd way, or not just in an arbitrary way. And I think it makes us more willing to bear with the suffering of being human. Another way to put it is I think that that perhaps being Christian gives us deeper resources for patience, which is actually from the Latin word suffering. Patience is the past participle or passive participle of the word to suffer. And to be patient is to have an ability to hold tension and even pain for the sake of something good. I think our neighbors struggle to do that for very understandable reasons. But once you've known Jesus and seen him on the cross, meditated on the cross, and also because we trust that the cross is not the last word, it gives us a capacity to bear with pain. We haven't talked about maybe an important thing, like which is how we engage with the people who actually can't be productive.
Yes.
And that's maybe the other part.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, talk about that
I was going to say, that I wanted to wrap up this time, and so I wanted you to speak about that, because in the book you talk about the community of the unuseful,
right,
and people who we might typically consider useless, and this is not my word, this is yours.
Yeah, yeah.
let him explain. No, really, what do you mean
present
by that?
Present company accepted. Yeah.
What do you mean by that, and how does that, how are we to change the way we regard others?
Yeah. Well, I'm picking up on a name, actually two names. I'll tell two quick stories. I'm picking up on a name in the New Testament, the name Onesimus. Onesimus is a slave. There's this very interesting book called Philemon where Paul, the writer of the letter, has met Onesimus. Well, Onesimus's name literally means useful, which is actually a very degrading thing to call a human being. Human beings are not here for one another's use. We are here to be beheld and known and loved, not as usefulness. Now, of course, it's a great joy to serve one another when it's free, but when you are reduced to your utility, you've been actually turned into a substitute for magic. So when we can't have magic, we'd like to have robots. Robots is just the Czech word for slave or serf. So when we can't have magic, we're like, bring the robots. And when the robots turn out not to do magic, we're like, bring the people to step in and do the useful thing that I wanted to get done with the snap of my fingers. Onesimus has been this, his whole name telegraphs that his identity, his entire life was usefulness. This is entirely, I would say, like a victory for mammon to get us to see other people as useful. But then there's other people who aren't even useful in mammon's terms. My niece, Angela Ricker, was born with trisomy 13, which means she has three copies. She died at the age of 12, three copies of every chromosome in every cell. And that's very confusing to the human body system. Angela never learned to speak. Hard to say what she could understand. She couldn't understand language, certainly. I don't know if she ever understood who her parents were. Very profound deficits. And when she was born, the doctors told my sister and her husband, they said, this is incompatible with life, this condition, and it's probably best that you leave her with us and we will care for her until the end. And my sister said, well, how long will that end be? And they were like, oh, not very long. And my sister said, well, if it's not going to be very long, then I want to take her home and tell me what it means to care for Angela. So it turns out that trisomy 13, in many cases, is a very swift, fatal disease. But in Angela's cases and others, in that case and others, she lived for 12 years. And I cannot tell you how Angela repaired my family. The subtle, no terrible trauma, but just subtle rifts and distance and growing apart and living in different cities and differences of personality, differences of story. And this person came into our midst who had such profound needs, could never be useful in any sense of the word, even useful. And caring for her as a family knit us back together and knit whole communities together. She went to kindergarten 7 years in a row, because there was no point in, you know, first grade was not going to be different for Angela. So, and the kindergartners loved her. And at her funeral in this little town in New Hampshire, there were 7 years worth of children who had gone to kindergarten with Angela who all came to her funeral. And this town, through one person who was of no use, had been brought together in the work of love. Now, mammon would tell you mammon like hates that story exists. And mammon would say, no, that's useless. Terminate that before it even begins. Don't care even if it should happen. You know, the unuseful, I wouldn't call any person, including Angela, useless. Only mammon would speak that way. But the unuseful, those who can't even rise to the level of utility in our productive economy, are the keys to real love. because if there's a society that will care for Angela, then there's a society that will care for me. Mm. But if there's not a society that will care for Angela, then I am driven to prove every day my usefulness, my utility, my functionality in the world of mammon. And so, like, the guarantee of personhood is how we treat those who cannot produce on mammon's terms, or even on technology's terms. Now, technology, of course, had uses in caring for Angela's needs, and she wouldn't have survived without lots of medical expertise, beautiful interventions, difficult, but beautiful interventions. But, you know, she couldn't use a smartphone. She couldn't, you know, she was outside that world. And when you entered, and to enter into that world, her world, you had to leave that world. And you found yourself, like, being a person again in a really powerful way. Mm. I said I would tell two stories, but I probably took too long.
There's one. I think we want to hear the other story. Is all that right, okay? Right. Yeah, okay, all right.
It can be told quickly. It's this little moment that ends up being a huge part of the next book. At the end of Romans 6, at the end of the book of Romans, the letter to the Romans, Romans 16, which is a whole bunch of greetings to persons by name. Like, ultimately what we're hoping for is that there's someone who knows our name. And Paul wants to convey to these Romans who are across the sea from him. He's writing in Corinth. They're all the way around the peninsula in Rome. He's like, I want you to know I know your names, as many of you as I can remember, because this is not just about, we're not here to just do magic for God and get stuff done. We're here to knit together ourselves as members of the body of Christ. But then there's this really interesting moment where the text says, I, Tertius, who wrote down this letter, greet you in the Lord. So what's going on here? Well, this is the scribe. Scribal greetings are not entirely unknown in Greco-Roman letters, but here's the scribe who's been writing down Paul's dictation. And then Tertius says, it seems that Tertius continues. He says, Gaius, who is host to me in the whole church, greets you. Erastus, the city treasurer, greets you. And so does the brother Quartus. Now, the interesting thing about Tertius is the meaning of the name. Number three. His name is third. Because the Romans were extremely practical. They basically named the firstborn, like Aquila, Eagle, you know, like, oh, they are my firstborn son, you know, we got a name for you. But by the time you get to number three, it's like number three. And Tertius may well also have been enslaved, right? He was someone who his whole life was known as number three. And he's been dutifully taking dictation. And then Paul, we have to imagine, stops and says, wait, Tertius, you should say hello. You're not just a functionary. You're not a dictation robot. You are a person. You greet them. And Tertius, it turns out, is at table with Gaius, who does have a name, which indicates status. He's a paterfamilias. He's the head of a household. Erastus, the CFO, basically, of the city. And Tertius, Gaius, and Erastus are at the table with Quartus, which is awesome, number four. Number four is there too. So this could be Tertius's little brother, right? Number three and number four are no longer just numbers. They have been included in this community, which includes Phoebe, who's going to carry the letter to Rome, Paul, who used to be Saul, who wouldn't even have eaten with half of the people at this table. And now they're all together. They are all known by name. They're greeting their friends by name across the sea. And they're knitting together in the midst of this super impersonal empire of Rome that will call people useful and number three. And it says, you are a person, you are a beloved child, you are a brother and a sister in a new family. And they started to change very gradually the social architecture of the Roman world. Hmm. I feel like that's what we need. We need that kind of renewal in our impersonal world. And it's going to start by finding the people who get neglected, who don't get noticed, re-knitting a world where at every moment we're treated as persons rather than objects of a system. And there's a lot to do to get there.
Yeah.
That was Andy Crouch speaking with me, Denise Lee Yon, Director of the Faith and Work Journey. Andy's new book, The Life We're Looking For, Reclaiming Relationship in a Technological World, which digs deep into the topics we discussed, is available now. We encourage you to check out the book and contact us at info@faithandworkjourney.com if you would like more insights about living integrated, holistic lives of flourishing. Thanks for listening.